It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about why the smoking rate for Native Americans is going up, and we'll hear about an effort to turn things around here in Wisconsin.
First, there are nearly 600 cities and villages in the state of Wisconsin, and they're home to a majority of the state's population.
A new report released for the first time this year provides a barometer of how cities and villages are doing, and among other things, how they're funding their services, how their citizens are faring, and more.
Joining us now to talk about the report is Jerry DeShane. He's the executive director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, which released the new report. Jerry, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Veronica. Thank you for having me.
Well, what were some of the key issues that this report wanted to take a look at?
Well, this was the baseline year. This is the first of an ongoing series of studies we're going to do. But we wanted to ask local governments about service levels. How's your police response time, your fire response time? What's the condition of your roads? What's your overall economic outlook generally?
And if you had to sum up what you found in a couple of words, what would you say?
Pretty good. Pretty good with some storm warnings on the horizon. I think what we found was that, by and large, most Wisconsin cities and villages came out of the Great Recession. They made some tough decisions, but managed fairly well with tight revenues. We're a little concerned about cutbacks in maintenance of streets, but the other thing we're a little concerned about is the smallest of the small. Wisconsin has a lot of very tiny villages and cities, and a number of those have not yet recovered from the recession.
Well, let's dig in a little to the pretty good aspect of what you found. How are cities, municipalities, villages doing when it comes to revenue?
Not bad. Over the period of this study was 2011 to 2014, and just for a point of comparison, local revenues over that period went up 2% over the 4 years. Revenue to the state went up 8%. But despite that, most of the cities and villages managed to maintain or even improve police response time, fire response time, ambulance response time. Where we saw a little bit of drop-off was in library spending, a little bit of a drop-off in some of the general government expenditures, and then also a little bit of a drop-off in street maintenance.
Now, again, was there a difference there that you found when you looked at the bigger urban areas versus the smaller cities and villages?
Yeah, that's something that I think we all need to be very aware of. There's a dramatic difference, frankly. Wisconsin's flagship cities, Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, Appleton, and on down the list, quite frankly, most of our medium-sized and large cities, they're attracting new residents, they're attracting millennials, people are moving to urban centers, and they're growing, they're developing, they're doing okay. That's not necessarily happening with all of our small, more rural villages and cities.
So when you look at those more rural places in Wisconsin, what are the biggest challenges that you're seeing there?
Well, the biggest challenge is simply demographics. They're aging. Their population is getting older. It's getting smaller. I do need to back up here because I'm at a conference of mayors, and a couple of small city mayors took issue with me. The mayor of Keel said, "We are doing just fine here, thank you." So you have to be careful not to say this is a problem everywhere. But the reality is Wisconsin generally and some of our smaller, more northern communities specifically are getting older and smaller, and they're simply going to have to make do with fewer citizens and, as a result, fewer tax dollars.
And I know one thing, a spot of concern in the report that came up was civic participation in some of these smaller places. What did you see there?
Well, it's either one heck of a compliment or it's a big worry. And frankly, I'm leaning toward worry. In most communities, and again, dramatically more so in small communities, the majority of offices, public elected offices, have one or fewer candidates running for them. We have some village boards out there that have vacancies simply because nobody wants the job.
Jerry DeShane is with us right now. He's the executive director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, joining us to talk about their new report on the state of cities and villages in Wisconsin. And let's talk about infrastructure next. This is a point of contention statewide. How are things like bridges and roads faring across the state?
Well, again, I have to start from pretty good, but about three-quarters of the local roads and bridges are in very good or good condition in Wisconsin. The problem is that percentage that are in very good or better condition has gone down 4 percentage points. It's gone down, and the percent of roads that are in fair or poor conditions is starting to rise. So what's happening here is we're seeing the impact of deferred maintenance.
And looking at something that concerns just about everybody, whether you live in a city or a rural area, is the availability of jobs. What did you find out about the employment picture in Wisconsin?
Well, the employment picture in Wisconsin is very good. Again, the bulk of those jobs are concentrating in our urban areas. The greater challenge is the number of bodies available to fill those jobs.
And any ideas about different directions that cities and smaller towns and villages are dealing with that problem?
Interestingly enough, today I'm at the annual Wisconsin workshop for mayors and other chief executives. And we're talking about that. We're talking about what does it take to, you know, be a risk taker, to be that visionary leader for your community. As I said, I hate to keep coming back to the village of Keele, but they believe they're doing very well. They're doing it very quietly. They don't want to make a lot of fanfare. But it starts with leadership at the local level.
Now, I know that you've said that we may think there sometimes there is this perceived gap between bigger cities in the state of Wisconsin and the rural areas of the state. But you point out, you like to make the point, that there is interconnectivity going on, that we rise and fall together. Do you see that playing out in the report?
Veronica, that's something I think we all need to think about and look at more often. What I like to point to is Harley-Davidson. They build body parts in Tomahawk, Wisconsin. So in order for Milwaukee to prosper, for Harley to prosper, Tomahawk has to prosper and vice versa. I think we're going to stress, the league will stress more and more that interconnectivity. The other thing, we talk about roads. Wisconsin has more paved roads than most other states. Historically, that's because we needed them to take care of our dairy farms. But from our perspective, that's an economic asset. That's an economic tool that we can use to move goods and services more efficiently.
So looking at some of those tools to bring to lift all boats, and how do you expect the state of Wisconsin and the cities and towns and villages you reported on, how do you expect these places to use this report to improve things moving forward?
Well, I think they want to take a look at what their assets are. In the examples, in the mayors today that sort of took issue with me, every one of them had a unique community asset, and they built on that asset. And I think the challenge for us is whether you're Milwaukee or the village of Strum up in Trempealeau County, what are your assets? What's unique about your community, and how do you build from there? That's where success lies.
Now, this report just came out. What are you expecting the next one, and what are you hoping to learn from that one?
We'll do the next report a year from now, and we will probably look at these same issues because we want to track them over time. But the other thing we're hearing about is placemaking, the sort of soft and squishy, not talking about blacktop and things like that, but talking about things that make communities unique. And I think we need to explore that a little bit more because this one was really very data heavy. The next one needs to be a little bit more, you know, what are your community amenities? What are the things about your communities that make it attractive? And see what that tells us.
Well, Jerry, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for your time, Veronica. I appreciate it.
Jerry DeShane is the executive director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, and he joined us to talk about their new report on the state of cities and villages in Wisconsin. You can read that report on the Wisconsin Public Radio website. It's WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll hear the story of how the head of Wisconsin's police union and the father of a son killed by a police officer found common cause and how they're hoping to improve the relationship between police and communities across the nation.
First, the overall use of cigarettes among U.S. adults continues to decline, according to new data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But some discrepancies do remain. While the smoking rate is going down among almost all racial and ethnic groups, it actually increased for one group, Native Americans.
The CDC compared the smoking rate for the years 2002 through 2005 and 2010 through 2013. And for Native Americans, it rose from about 37% to around 39%. And to put that into context, the smoking rate for both whites and blacks in America is around 25%.
Clinton Isham joins us now. He's the program director for the Wisconsin Native American Tobacco Network. Clinton, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio today.
Hey, thank you.
So we heard that data from the CDC, smoking rates going down for everyone, but staying high, going up a little even for Native Americans. So do we have a sense of why that might be?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me today, to everybody in the studio. It's important to look at some of the stuff that they stated in the CDC report and also the article that I looked at through the Post. Something that we need to look at is the time between the data was collected. In this time was when we seen a lot of these national smoke-free policies that were being implemented. And here in Wisconsin, we saw an entire smoke-free statewide smoke-free initiatives. So what happened with a lot of those policies were these proven strategies and interventions that were developed to help kind of coordinate all this and getting the smoking rates down. If we look at some of the data in these reports, we see that some groups were left out, and meaning that in particular that how we're viewing it at this point is that a lot of these strategies and interventions simply don't work for some of these groups. And it's not only Native Americans, it's also several subgroups that they mention in the CDC report.
So what kind of efforts are you working on in Wisconsin, more tailored to, in this case, the Native American community?
So something that we do in particular at Wisconsin Native American Tobacco Network, which is housed out of the Great Lakes Intertribal Council, and we're supported through a state Wisconsin tobacco program, is we coordinate with the 11 tribes in trying to figure out what intervention works best for them. So we coordinate with these tribes in doing that, and it's a similar message with Wisconsin tribes. It's that that tobacco, the message of tobacco needs to be taken very differently than we see it taken on a conventional standpoint. It's something that is embedded within the history, culture, and sovereignty with Wisconsin tribes. And so when we're working in Wisconsin tribes looking at interventions, we need to be mindful of that and respectful to the ideologies of tobacco first and foremost.
Yeah, I was reading a publication from your organization comparing and contrasting what I guess we could call traditional tobacco use versus buying a pack of cigarettes at the store. A very different culturally, and even a different kind of tobacco. It's a different strain, different species of tobacco.
Yeah, definitely. Do you want me to elaborate?
Can you talk about some of the differences between the two?
Yeah. Okay, for sure. So we all know when we pick up a cigarette, we're using it for recreational use, or we're getting something out of it, pleasure for ourselves individually. So what traditional tobacco is, I'm not here to speak on the stories and the meaning of everything, because I don't even understand the full context of traditional tobacco. Something I can show you guys is, I know our listeners can't see this in here, but so this, I brought in traditional tobacco with me, and I want to share it with you guys and give you my perspective and how my relationship is with traditional tobacco.
Sure. And this is in what looks like a leather pouch?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm going to give a pinch to each person in here.
Okay.
And, you know, feel free to look at it and smell it and look at the difference of it. Of the tobacco here than what you see in a traditional cigarette. So what I just did was I gave this tobacco for you, but it's not really for you. Mm. it's for the message that we're giving out here on the air on air today. It's the message that, hey, this is something that the effects of commercial tobacco is something that we need to take seriously in Wisconsin still with Native American groups and other groups. And so a part of me giving you that tobacco is saying thank you. Not only thank you to you, but thank you to the Creator for allowing this message to go forth. And so this tobacco isn't necessarily for you to put in a cigarette, mm-hmm. or to smoke, or to put under your lip for any sort of pleasure. It's for you to just simply carry out the message by taking it outside when you guys are finished here and placing it by a tree or putting it out in the water and allowing that message to be carried through in a more interconnected way. So that's my perspective on traditional tobacco. It's that it's used to give thanks, and it's used to ask for something that's, something far more significant than what, we're sitting in here doing right now.
So it sounds like tobacco, there's a lot more weight to it in a way when used traditionally. It's not just, I'm going to open another pack of cigarettes as any smoker, Native American otherwise, would do. This is something that's bound up in history, culture for generations.
Yes, definitely. And, being mindful that not all American Indian cultures would have this in a part of their histories, but a lot of them do, mm-hmm. and a lot of them see traditional tobacco in a different way than we see commercial tobacco.
So is it your hope that kind of bringing back this tradition of tobacco as it once was, that's going to be part of the message in breaking the smoking patterns that we have today?
So, yeah, thank you for asking that. I want to be very clear that that this type of tobacco is still very much a part of communities, and people still use traditional tobacco,
sure.
and it's grown in a very sacred way still by people that have carried on the stories from a long time ago. What my hope is, and especially being here today, is that some of the listeners are really tuning in to the message of that... We should be looking at some of the initiatives that the state of Wisconsin has already done regarding tobacco control and applaud them for those, because there's been a lot of work done, but also being clear to legislators and our governor that, hey, we still have a lot more to do, not only with natives but with non-natives. And so there's still a lot more work to do, and specifically with natives, because, that's why I'm here talking today, is we need to pull our resources together and work together in looking at tribal sovereignty for solutions. Something that the Post article looked at or suggested was that one of the problems with this issue lies within tribal sovereignty. I just want to say that tribal sovereignty is where the solution lies. We need to seek out tribal leaders, tribal organizations like Great Lakes Intertribal Council, and tribal members that are agents for policy change on these reservations, work with these people in getting their perspective on what are proven strategies, what are the interventions that work best for their communities.
Talking to Clinton Isham, he's program director for the Wisconsin Native American Tobacco Network. And you mentioned tribal sovereignty as an issue. And that Washington Post article you referred to talked about tobacco tax increases that came into effect in states, I think at the federal level, but not on tribal territory in the nation. And that apparently they're saying might be one reason for this divergence in smoking rates. So do you see a solution to that maybe coming from tribal governments?
So the solution has to come from both ways, like I mentioned. Something that the article mentions also is that tobacco companies, they're very strategic in who they target. In who they target are people of color, people of lower socioeconomic status, and people of lower education. And in several of these are which Native Americans fall within this targeted category. So they're targeting Native American communities all around the United States to continue smoking, to continue with a lower tax rate for cigarettes, for casino stuff. So when I say the answer lies within tribal sovereignty, we need to really look at who are some of these leaders that are making these changes. And the one person or the one entity that I can talk about right now is looking at the Madison Casino. Last year, August 2015, they did a total comprehensive smoke-free initiative within their casino. They are leading the way for tribal casinos and saying, hey, we no longer want this a part of our casino. That's tribal sovereignty at its best. And so for the listeners here, I would really encourage you, especially the Madison listeners, to go to the Madison Casino and find their comment cards and thank Madison Casinos, thank Ho-Chunk Nation for their initiative, and thank the executive manager there, Daniel Brown, for his leadership in that.
Do you see other, what you see as positive signs like that in the effort against tobacco use, cigarette smoking, commercial cigarette smoking among Native Americans?
Can you repeat that?
What do you see other positive signs along with that change in that casino?
I think there's a lot of positive stuff going on in tribal communities. Not only looking at some of the stuff, the health disparities, but things around education and in several other things. Tribal communities are doing an excellent job with getting kids to school and to higher education and making sure resources are allocated the proper way. What we need, again, with this public health issue is agencies like the CDC and other large funders to start to look at tribal agencies, tribal programs, tribal leaders for the solutions. What are we going to do about this? What are the strategies that work here? This is where we're going to find the solution that we're talking about today.
So very briefly, it sounds like if tribal leadership isn't at the table in anti-smoking efforts, we're not going to see a lot of success.
I think even if tribal leaders aren't at the table, in which they are at a lot of other tables for a multitude of things, there's tribal organizations that take this issue seriously, like Great Lakes Intertribal Council. And so, this issue, it's something that it's very difficult for somebody to look at and to read these reports. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of hope. I think I want to thank the Wisconsin State Tobacco Program for their efforts. And I think there's a lot of good things being done, but we need to pull together and continue to fight this together.
Clinton, thanks a lot for joining us today. That's Clinton Isham, Program Director for the Wisconsin Native American Tobacco Network.
Coming up after the news, we'll hear how the head of Wisconsin's police union and the father of a son killed by a police officer are looking to improve the relationship between police and communities across the nation. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll celebrate 100 years of the National Park Service and look ahead at the challenges facing the parks in the coming years.
First, tensions between communities and law enforcement seem to be boiling over in many parts of the country, leading to protests and, in some cases, to violence. Most recently, crowds took to the streets in Milwaukee to protest the shooting death of an armed man by a police officer. There's a growing sense that more needs to be done to get law enforcement and their communities talking to each other in order to ease tensions and come up with lasting solutions.
While things are far from perfect between police and civilians here in Wisconsin, one of the most striking examples of reconciliation took place here in recent years. It involved the head of the state's police union and the father of a man shot and killed by law enforcement. Despite their obvious differences, the two were able to come together and find common ground, leading to the passage of the law that mandates independent investigations of officer-involved deaths, a law that's widely seen as one of the most progressive of its kind in the country. Now, in a story that ran in the most recent Politico magazine, the two are sharing their story in hopes that their success can be replicated across the country.
Jim Palmer and Michael Bell are joining us now. Jim is the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. And Jim, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Michael Bell is with us as well. He's an activist and a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force. Michael, welcome.
Thank you, Veronica, for having me on your show.
And Michael, we're going to start with you because this story, in many ways, it starts with you. You've been on the show sharing your story before, but for those who are hearing you for the first time, can you briefly tell the story of what happened with your son?
In 2004, I had a son that was coming home from a night out with friends. He was met in front of his home by a police officer. There was some discussion. My son was under the influence. Eventually, my son was tased, and he ran to the back of the house. An officer and my son had a physical confrontation. Eventually, an officer screamed, "He has my gun," but the family members saw Michael with his hands behind his back, cuffed. And at that point, another officer placed a gun directly to Michael's temple and took his life. And I essentially questioned what had gone on, because within 48 hours, the department had reviewed itself and cleared itself of wrongdoing.
And you were used to the way the National Transportation Safety Board conducted investigations. You were surprised at the way the investigation unfolded.
I was surprised. I flew the KC-135, which was a Boeing 707, and so therefore I had a tremendous amount of aviation experience. And I studied accident investigations to make sure that myself and others stayed alive. And I was expecting a National Transportation Safety Board type investigation, but that didn't occur.
And thank you for sharing that. I know it's still not an easy story, so years later, thank you. And Jim, I want to turn to you now. From a law enforcement perspective, Michael at that point began his life as an activist and a father, and he started to raise questions. He started to go public with those questions. What was your first reaction when you started to see his role in this?
Well, the first time I heard the name Michael Bell was, I believe, in 2005. Our organization is the state's largest law enforcement group. Annually issues service awards to officers that have gone above and beyond the call of duty. And the officers in Kenosha that were involved in Michael's son's altercation were among those being recognized at our annual event. And Mike had taken out ads in numerous national newspapers, New York Times, Chicago Tribune, and others, to publicly criticize the organization. For doing so. And that was my first exposure to Michael Bell. And in the years from 2005 to about 2012, he was increasingly involved in a public media campaign using billboards and television advertisements and other measures to draw awareness to the issue and the question as to whether or not law enforcement agencies should investigate themselves.
And was that a question you had asked yourself before, as someone who was a leader in law enforcement? Had you asked why law enforcement investigated themselves?
Well, and there were some practical reasons. In a lot of cases, they're historical in nature. You know, these larger agencies in particular that have the manpower, that have the expertise and the resources to conduct these investigations, which are complicated endeavors. And I think there was just a real concern about, passing those investigations off to an outside agency. And there was maybe a real proprietary sense about those investigations. And it took a number of years, and largely due to Michael's public efforts to draw awareness to the issue, and that helped initiate a discussion.
And I know at some point you two were not on cordial terms. There was tension between the two of you. Michael had initiated a billboard that you felt unfairly maybe represented officers under investigation. And it's sort of at this time where, Michael, you decided, I'm gonna be audacious. I'm gonna try to meet with this man and see if we can see eye to eye. Tell me about that first meeting and how it happened.
There was a local shooting here in Madison, and I was in Madison to assist with bringing some awareness to the situation. And I was actually driving up John Nolan Drive past the WPPA, and I was on the phone with one of our team members. And she said to me, she says, "Why don't you stop in and say hello to Jim Palmer?"
Almost as a joke, right?
Almost as a joke. And my first reaction was "No way" in capital letters. But then I had been studying people that had made great change. Gandhi and George Patton was one of those people. And I remember him saying, "Audacity, audacity, always audacity." And I said, "I am going to step out my comfort zone, and I'm going to go into that parking lot, and I'm going to see if Jim Palmer's there at the WPPA."
And Jim, there you are. You're in your office. This is someone who's you're not necessarily on friendly terms with. What made you decide to see him?
Well, we had I think one initial exchange or set of exchanges via email, and it was pretty. There was some animosity. We weren't very happy with some of the billboards that he was running at the time in the Madison area, and obviously, he has his concerns that he had been expressing over many years. And it was in that initial exchange that we talked about the possibility of possibly meeting. Michael had raised the issue, and I said that I would be happy to, and I thought there was value in that, but it's not something I was going to do at the tip of a spear, and I just couldn't do it and maintain the credibility of officers across the state that we represent while these billboards were up. And so when he showed up in my office, we kind of had rehashed, I think, a lot of that same discussion. And
But in a civil way.
It wasn't civil. It was certainly a face-to-face. But shortly after that meeting, he had agreed to let those initial billboards run out. I think he initially had contemplated having longer runs in addition to the initial ones. And that opened the doorway for us to begin to meet and to start to build trust and to build a dialogue.
We're talking with Jim Palmer right now and Michael Bell. Their story is featured in an article for Politico magazine. It's called Reaching Across the Thin Blue Line, How the Head of a Police Union, that's Jim Palmer, and the father of a son killed by a police officer, it's Michael Bell, found common cause. And building trust. So there you are. There's not necessarily a lot of trust to begin with. You have to build this from the ground up. Michael, how did you begin to do it?
Laughingly, I just told Jim, I says, "What if I would have said to him 3 years ago when we first met for the first time that we were going to be in WPPR doing an interview together, we would never have believed it." But Jim and I sat down, and to Jim's credit, he listened to me as a father. He has his own sons. And I also listened to Jim about his love and deep love and respect for the people that wear a uniform. But we had a common bond. He has a brother that's an Air Force officer. And being an Air Force officer myself, we saw each other as human beings. And we sat down. We had some dialogue. And he essentially said to me, he says, if the billboards are down, we might be able to have some dialogue about the laws that you seek, because I talked with him about the National Transportation Safety Board issues that I was looking at.
And Jim, was it that for you that enabled you to reach across this divide, the brotherhood of both being fathers, respecting people in uniform, that began it for you as well?
I think that was one of many critical turning points, and that our initial meeting after his audacious meeting. Where we hear a lot around the country about the need for people to show empathy to one another, and the NYPD commissioner Bill Bratton recently said we need to recognize each other's humanity. But I don't really think we know what that means to a large extent. And for us, it was just recognizing that we're fathers before we're anything else, and kind of build off that common feature that we shared. And being able to set aside our animosity and frustrations and using that as a platform to open up to one another, get to know one another, and to be able to share our perspectives with one another was a real launching pad.
And Michael, you're not just a father, you're an activist. And you got together at a certain point, and it's more than this common trust, although nothing could have happened without that, but you wanted to affect change. So how did the two of you begin to talk about reform, changing the way things were done?
We actually sat at the conference table over at the WPPA headquarters. He sat on one side, I sat on another, and we talked about concepts that I felt should be introduced. And then he would turn around and either poke holes in them, or he would say, yeah, that's not a bad idea. We might be able to do that. Jim would share with me the inside workings of legislation and law enforcement, and I shared with him my perspective on how pilots avoid from crashing aircraft and what the investigations are like when they do. And so that's what Jim and I had done together. And it was a process that took months, and there were some cancellations, and then there were some additional shootings within the state and so forth. Those were all awkward moments for us, but we maintained a high level of respect, and we kept working together.
And Jim, just briefly, here you are, you're the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. What do your colleagues make of you sitting down with this person who's been putting up these billboards that have been upsetting to some people? How do you get them to understand what you're after?
Well, I am blessed to serve at the pleasure of a 27-member board of directors of officers, rank-and-file officers that are elected across the state. And they recognize that as the state's largest law enforcement group, we really had an obligation to maintain an open mind and to be willing to explore whether or not things could be done better. And, there are other law enforcement groups, I think, that they raise an eyebrow and were unsure of where this was going to go or what the motivations were. And So there was some of that for sure. But at the end of the day, you know, we had an organization that was, you know, committed to fulfilling a kind of a societal sense of responsibility that we feel we have given our size.
And the end result legislation that was groundbreaking for Wisconsin and for the nation, and we'll get to that when we come back. We're talking right now with Michael Bell and Jim Palmer. The story they wrote is featured in Politico magazine. It's called Reaching Across the Thin Blue Line, How the Head of a Police Union and the Father of a Son Killed by a Police Officer Found Common Cause.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think law enforcement and community members can best engage in productive dialogue? What issues need to be brought to the table? Who needs to be the one to start these conversations? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking right now with Michael Bell and Jim Palmer. Their story is featured in an article for Politico magazine called Reaching Across the Thin Blue Line, How the Head of a Police Union and the Father of a Son Killed by a Police Officer Found Common Cause. They're sharing their story in hopes that other communities can replicate their success.
You can join us now at 800-642-1234. How do you think law enforcement and community members can best engage in productive dialogue? And what are the biggest issues do you think that require attention? Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Michael, ultimately, the two of you, Jim Palmer yourself, worked on legislation that would go on to become law in 2014. And this is the bill that mandates independent investigations into officer-involved deaths, and the first statewide bill of its kind and in the nation. Didn't come necessarily easily. As we heard, there's already a long backstory, but then there were roadblocks once you got to this point where the two of you were on the same page. Michael, what did it take to get this bill passed?
Well, it took, as Representative Gary Bies once said, he said this thing was on life support a number of times. It took a lot of hard work, and I remember having to make a decision one morning to take out very expensive advertising in USA Today to tell millions of people what we were doing here in Wisconsin. And that was imagine trying to make a very expensive decision, like without even contacting your spouse about it, because I knew she was going to have no part of it. Jim had to, I would go into legislation. Office and they would say Jim Palmer was here today, and I'd go in another legislator's office and he says Jim Palmer was here today. Jim practically had to go into every single legislator's office at the Capitol to tell them that the WPPA supported this bill because they were petrified of being labeled as anti-reform law enforcement.
Jim, do you remember that time going to knocking on a lot of doors, making the case? Was it a tough sell at the time?
You know, it's always a tough sell. I mean, you know, this legislation was introduced in, I believe, August of 2013, and the legislative session ends in April of 2014. And so that's a pretty small window. And it's not uncommon for bills, when they're introduced in the state legislature, to, you know, have to go through a couple 2-year legislative cycles before they actually see the light of day and get a vote. And so it was an arduous process. You know, one of the things that we did that was helpful is we conduct a statewide poll every year through the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute, and we polled on this issue specifically. And it was something well over 80% of the public supported the independent investigations of these officer-related deaths. And we promoted that through a statewide media tour and with legislative offices all across the Capitol. And I think that helped in conjunction with the efforts that that Michael was taking.
So it came from both sides here, and you had bipartisan support for this bill as well. So,
which is also very unusual. I mean, obviously, it's a very not just in Wisconsin, but nationally, it's a very partisan, ideologically divisive environment, and so it's pretty extraordinary.
Madison's own Representative Chris Taylor was on the Democratic side. She was a human rights advocate, and on the other side, we had Representative Gary Bies, who was a Republican, retired chief deputy sheriff from the Door County region. So they kept everybody at peace.
And Michael, I'm curious, in conjunction with Jim Palmer's efforts there, knocking on doors, talking about this survey, what did that ad say that you placed in USA Today?
The ad said that that Wisconsin tragedies mirrored national problems, and we brought to light that Frank Serpico, the famous NYPD detective that Al Pacino made a movie regarding his life, endorsed our reforms. You have to understand that this type of legislation is very, very difficult to pass. Ferguson, Missouri, happened about 4 months after we passed this legislation, and they've twice introduced our bill, word for word, down there, and they couldn't even get it out of committee. I testified down at the Capitol in Jefferson City. I had also gone to New Jersey and spoke with legislators there. Word for word, they couldn't even get it out of committee. I am telling you that when I testified in front of the President's Task Force on Policing, I saw other union leaders, and I can tell you right now that I think that we were very fortunate to have a forward-thinking leader at the WPPA to do this. And right now, between body cameras and this legislation, Wisconsin looks pretty darn good.
We've definitely made some gains. And obviously, there are, as we saw in Milwaukee a few weeks ago, there are others to make. And they're not all law enforcement related, but law enforcement, I think, needs to be an integral part of that discussion.
And this law has been in effect since 2014?
That's correct.
And what do you think the result is so far? Both of you, why don't we start with you, Jim, since you're with the Professional Police Association.
Sure, and we represent most of the officers that are involved in these sensitive situations year in and year out. And I think that the law has really helped maintain the public's trust and credibility in these investigations. And because these are, these impact deeply, not only, loved ones of someone who's shot by a law enforcement officer, but the community. It can rock a community. And so to know that it's going to be independently and transparently investigated in a way that, for the most part, isn't done anywhere else around the country, with the exception of two other states, I think is very helpful. And it's something that protects both the public and law enforcement officers alike.
And Michael, what's your take?
Well, it was a little bit hard to implement because once it occurred, you had a shooting here in Dane County, and then you had a Dontre Hamilton shooting in Milwaukee on the same day. And it took a lot of effort to get it done. One of the things that I'm really proud of is that Governor Walker, in his budget, included additional money for the Department of Justice so they can bring in their own investigators, because now the load was being placed on the Department of Justice. Those are little steps along the way that got us to where we are today. There was one, for the first time in the history of Wisconsin, there was a firing of an officer in Milwaukee procedurally. But I think it adds a lot of credibility to law enforcement and the community.
And I want to ask you both, we're at a time today when relations between police and communities, the communities that they police, are under stress and under scrutiny, sometimes under extreme stress in some cases. Do you see the process that the two of you went through, seeing each other? I think, Jim, you said recognizing the humanity in each other, and from there, working on policy and change. Do you see that as a template for the rest of the country?
I truly do. I think, first and foremost, there are some lessons that can be gained from our experience. One is that people need to recognize the need for relationships. And once you recognize that those relationships are needed, then you can work on building them. And empathy is a critical building block in those relationships. And then that just helps facilitate a dialogue. And I think that's enormously constructive to the problems that are facing our country and where we need to go on a broader scale.
And I think that this is a great way to approach this. Jim recently told me that he would be open to have dialogues with professions of other high hazard occupations to see if there's anything that could be learned from those professions. I would like to have a national conference right here in the state of Wisconsin, because I think we're the leader in this, and we can bring in people from the NTSB, we can bring in people from the United States Air Force training academies, and allow them to talk to law enforcement and see if there's anything that can occur and we can improve the situation from.
And the two of you, this is, you said, your first interview together.
It is. We've done joint interviews where we've been interviewed separately, but this is the first time sitting side by side. So
just a couple seconds left. What do you want people to take away going forward?
I would like them to read the article in Politico. And the other thing is please keep an open mind that law enforcement is a very tough job. We respect law enforcement, but we don't accept a bad policing. And I think an NTSB model might be one of our solutions going forward.
I think across the country, we just we need to be open to, you know, we talk about the need for a dialogue, and we see that a lot throughout the country, but it just hasn't started in earnest in many places. And I think, you know, by recognizing the need for a relationship and exercising some empathy, that would be enormously helpful.
Thank you both so much for joining us today in studio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Jim Palmer and Michael Bell. Jim's the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Michael is an activist, father, and a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force. Their article featured in Politico magazine is called Reaching Across the Thin Blue Line.
Here at Wisconsin Public Radio, producer Chris Molina is one of our biggest fans of snack foods, especially ones that have weird and wacky flavors. He brings them in to share with us, and today he took things too far. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Rob. Yeah, you didn't think I took it far enough in the past, so I decided to take it one step further today. So I decided to make everyone's day a little bit brighter by bringing in the Swedish Fish Oreos, which are the new hit snack product.
Right. You've taken us through a bunch of weird flavors of Oreos
so far. It's true,
yeah. Most of them have been okay.
Chocolate chip was good. The ones before that, maybe a little bit better. But we entered uncharted territory today.
Swedish fish flavor. Now, I don't like Swedish fish as a candy to begin with, but I tried it. My reaction, not good. Did anybody like these?
You know, I don't think anyone actually liked them. I went in with higher expectations than most because I do have, you know, the affinity for bizarre snack foods. Mm-hmm. However, I did get descriptions from coworkers such as it tastes like chocolate-covered children's Tylenol.
Or cough medicine.
Yeah, and those are some of the better ones, too. So I think the verdict was not all that great, but it's not going to deter me from bringing in weird things in the future.
It was bad. And then the aftertaste hit, and it was worse. But, hey, maybe what's the next thing you'd want to see put in an Oreo or other similar treat?
Well, I don't know. Like, if it's going to be on this candy trend, I'm not sure I'm excited about any of those possibilities. But I'm still holding out for, like, gingerbread or something. I think that's got to be a good one, right?
Still living the dream here on Central Time.